That's a reflection of my Midwestern upbringing, you know, the fact that you can understand it. If I had come from the West Coast, I would have been writing this touchy-feely, God's eye, spiritualist poetry. And if I had come from the East Coast, I would have been an intellectual that would have been writing John Ashbery-style poems that would have been cryptic. And many of my poems are stories mixed with lyricism.
Well, let's talk about the poems, because most of them, if not all, in your new collection, Everything Shapes Itself to the Sea, is set in the island of Barbados. So how
Correct.
Did that come about?
I got a Fulbright teaching scholarship to teach at the University of the West Indies in Cave Hill campus in Barbados. And that was shortly after I got married. And just being immersed in a different culture in the Caribbean, I mean, I found myself writing. You know, I kept a journal. I wrote a ton of poems. I wrote some short stories. And I wrote criticism, too, literary criticism. I was just on a roll.
Some modern poets, very successful contemporary poets like Mary Oliver, write about the daily life that surrounds them. Do you think that it's helpful, too, to get out of your natural environment and into another environment? Does that heighten the senses in some ways for a writer and particularly a poet?
Oh, certainly. I always tell my students, get out of your comfort zone. Situate yourself someplace where you feel uncomfortable, you feel out of place. I mean, that's not what I did deliberately here, but I think there's a tradition in American literature of the outsider. And to go to a different culture, to be that outsider and to see that culture for the first time. And I think what you're seeing then is your own culture through that lens of a different culture. There's a comparative aspect here that's unavoidable.
There are many beautiful poems in here where you're just kind of recording conversations that you hear. You're sitting in a bar, or I believe one is in a barber shop, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, yeah, it might sound like a barber shop, but the rum shops in Barbados were the real social centers, and it was kind of sexist, as it was mostly men there, only occasionally a woman. But that's where all of the men would just hang out and gather. And so I found myself drawn to them because, let's face it, I'm an academic. But after spending a whole day on campus, I don't want to spend my night with academics as well. So I hung out at some of the rum shops in Barbados.
There's one poem called Sweet Fudays, F-U-H, fa.
Yeah.
What's that mean?
Well, it's a saying that the men used, and it's just how you were just kind of pleasantly out of it for a number of days, and you just felt so not necessarily high, but yeah.
So sweet fuh, F-U-H as in four.
Yes.
Sweet for days.
Uh-huh.
Would you mind reading a part of that poem?
Not at all. Dominoes shape the mornings at Pearls, arranged like a geometry of side streets whose crossroads always seem to meet here. On a small wooden tabletop, players slam their cards with the force of light that pries through the bars of this rum shop's windows and the force of every bad hand that anyone here has ever been dealt. But it's only play. Some of the taxi drivers will come to this place for a snap of rum or a cold Banks beer to watch the players still slamming them down and chattering. I tell you, boy, me drink so much and dance so much, me can hardly remember she name. Me was so sweet for days. The drivers will laugh and shake their heads, maybe set a fresh bottle of white rum on the table, their own cargoes of stories bursting at the hold.
So beautiful and so evocative of the place. And there's another one that I love in here where you're basically just recording almost the dialogue that you're hearing. And it's people talking about very ordinary things, but through a poet's eyes and ears, it becomes something much more.
Well, and what was interesting to me, too, is that there wasn't just one dialogue or dialect. It depended on the age of the person. It depended on their gender to some degree. It depended on how many years they've been in Barbados. It depended on, in the case of our good friend Joseph Lynch, who ran this rum shop called Paradise Hideaway, Joe had gone to London, and he had spent most of his adult life in London, and he came back to the island to retire. And he was treated as much of an outsider, almost, as we were, where you have to kind of earn their respect and earn your way back into this whole, you know, insider status. And part of this book was about the experience of being an outsider, but yet, as one woman reminded us at some point, no, don't be pulling anything on us, cousin. You know, we're here for too long to be simply tourists.
You're listening to Sound Ideas. I'm Judy Valente. I'm talking with James Plath of Illinois Wesleyan University, who has a new collection of poetry out. This is a themed collection of poetry. That seems to be a trend now, that poets are putting out collections that have to do with a certain theme.
Yeah, it really is. And a lot of poets are calling these project books. You know, so what's your project? Oh, everything's going to have to do somehow with loss. Everything is. So it can be an abstract unifying principle. But more often than not, it ends up being something like, okay, poems related to my father, poems related to, you know, a honeymoon, poems related to whatever. And so for me, many of these poems were written way back in, you know, 1995, but I've been working on them ever since and adding to them. So I think the oldest poem in the collection was written way back then, and the newest poem was written just last year. And so the collection spans a long period. Part of the problem for me is I would write poems based on just whatever came into mind, whatever inspired me. But these project books, these theme books, you have to really be immersing yourself in them the same way that you would a novel. And that takes some time. That takes some doing. So for me, it was more of an evolving process, as opposed to I'm just going to sit down and I'm going to write a bunch of Barbados poems.
People who write poetry out there are listening and saying, this is a lucky fella to get his collection published. How difficult is it these days in the publishing world for poets?
If you already have a reputation and you already, you know, have a name, then it's not difficult at all. You can just approach your press and you're good. You're good as gold. But if you're someone who is unknown, relatively speaking, what you need to do is to win a contest. And I was resistant to this for so many years. I mean, I think back to when I edited and published Clockwatch Review. And
A literary journal out of Illinois Wesleyan.
Yeah. And this was at a time when a lot of people may not know this, but in the early 90s, Bloomington Normal was more of a literary center than Chicago. I mean, you had Lucia Getzey doing Spoon River Poetry Review. You had Gene Lee doing Farmer's Market Literary Magazine. You had Bob Sutherland with his Pikestaff Forum. You had me doing Clockwatch at ISU. You had Druid's Cave, which was very active. Bloomington even got into the act with their Words Fair. That was a huge deal, concerts that they would have in Franklin Park.
Wasn't another Illinois Wesleyan professor?
Jim McGowan was the one who ran that for many years. And then you had Charlie Harris and the Pub Unit and the American Book Review. You had John O'Brien, Dalkey Archive Press, Kurt White, Fiction Collective 2. I mean, this was a real happening place for publishing.
And
one
happened?
Of our biggest challenges was raising money. A lot of people got grants from the Illinois Arts Council. Now those grants have pretty much dried up and they're not worth the paperwork. A lot of people like myself would do other projects to raise money. I mean, I had celebrity auctions. I'd write to celebrities and have them send me back things, and I would have an auctioneer come in from Wapella and do a fun auction. And so we were always doing things to avoid making people pay a reading fee, which was starting to become popular. But the contests and the reading fees have taken over. It's just too impossible now in this climate to do anything other than those contests.
Do you think we can get back to those days where people consider poetry an important part of the inner life?
I wish we could, but I don't think so. Poetry is still one of those things that's perceived as fluff, as something unnecessary, as opposed to fiction, which is takes up more of an entertainment block. And I think people are wanting to be entertained these days more than they want to be provoked into thought or reverie or something. And yet, when they study poems in school, you know, stopping by the woods on a snowy evening. We're going to be doing that soon. You get a poem like that, and there's something classic about it. What would make a current poem classic? I mean, I've thought about this now, and I'm not sure that I have an answer for that. I think that it's a very narrow window to become classic. I think poetry really has almost been replaced by lyrics, by music, and in terms of popular appeal. And I think we saw this with Bob Dylan being awarded the Nobel Prize. Of course, there was politics involved as well, but I think that's a legitimization of the lyric as poetry.
Well, Jim, I don't know if these poems in your collection, Everything Shapes Itself to the Sea, will become classics, but there are so many beautiful poems in here, and many of them are love poems. So I'd like to maybe end with you reading one of the love poems. You were sort of on your honeymoon, as you mentioned. I'd like to end with you reading a love poem for your wife, Zarina Mullen Plath, who used to teach at Illinois Wesleyan and now teaches at
Mulberry School.
Mulberry School. Would you be so kind as to read one?
Sure. This poem is called Birdwatching 8 a.m., and it's dedicated to my wife. And that was part of our morning routine in Barbados. We stayed at a place called Paradise Villas, little apartments, and we would sit out there with our coffee and watch the mongoose. We'd watch the birds. We'd watch the kingbirds. And these birds were fascinating to us because there's nothing that predatory and that skillful in our neighborhood. Anyway, Birdwatching 8 a.m., when I breathe the way one raindrop smells before the sky unzips itself, when the nut of morning cracks open and trills pour in through the open louvers, each note a kingbird's plaintive cry, begging her mate to take off and swoop in cat-stretch arc, to snatch food from midair and tuck it into her grateful throat, red as last night's sunset. When I witness doves dancing on the patio through the vapors of our morning coffee, heads curling like tender vines, or recall the easy passion of Calypso that drifts from the port at night and laps against the shores of our sleep, I begin to think all I really need is to be with you, maybe help each other pry open this geode world with the loving precision of a kingbird's beak.
That was James Plath reading his poem, Birdwatching 8 a.m. James Plath teaches in the Creative Writing Program and Journalism Program at Illinois Wesleyan University. His new collection is called Everything Shapes Itself to the Sea. Thanks so much for coming in and talking about one of my favorite subjects, poetry.
You're welcome, and thanks for helping to get the word out about poetry. It's always exciting to have a new collection out, especially one that you could actually get on Amazon.
Get that plug in. Okay. Thanks to James Plath. I'm Judy Valente.